You're listening to episode 19 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with Joe Wetzel and Keith Curtis. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 4 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
I'm Carla.
And this is Chris.
And joining us today, we have two guests. We have Joe Wetzel.
Hello.
And the famous or infamous Keith Curtis.
Hey, everybody.
All right.
Well, so, Keith, is this the part of the show where we take over, steal the show from Dan, and talk about Superman for the next hour?
Yeah, like you guys never done that before.
Let's talk about Batman this time.
Ooh.
I just happened to have a Batman hoodie that I wore over here today.
It even has the bat ears.
Yeah, yes. The bat ears are on the hoodie part.
Okay. You should have Dan wear the Batman hoodie with his Batman underwear. That'd
be so Dawn came home, and Dan is always getting on me that I am not introducing Sky to enough Batman. And he's like, oh, look at that kid. He's got Spider-Man shoes. Oh, he's got the...
Well, I bust Pat about this far more often
yeah,
than I do you.
You do. Fair enough. But you do bust me about it. So let me tell you, Dan. Sky and Dawn were at Target shopping for clothes. Sky runs over and says, Mommy, I want this. It is Batman pajamas with a cape.
That is correct. The world is right.
It's not special. It's not anything good. It's just correct.
Is the cape like permanent on the pajamas?
Yes, it's like a Batman cape. It's a black two-piece sort of thing, and it's got like a utility belt and everything.
Yeah. And once he puts it on, the Batman identity is permanent.
That's right.
All you need to do now is you need to get a life-size stuffed toddler.
Uh-huh.
Put it in a Superman outfit and have Sky whoop the shit out of it.
I can arrange
Chad,
that.
Chad, you can sit back and pretend that you're Frank Miller.
Which basically means I will enjoy your household for a short period of time, after which it will be completely no longer worth visiting.
Totally.
Hey, welcome back, by the way, Chad.
Why, thank you. Yeah, my work stuff is finally taken care of, so
yeah,
so I'm back permanently.
Actually, right now we have a good problem, which is we're doing an inventory. It's like, wow, we have between regular and revolving hosts, we have like 8 people. Like,
yeah.
I was talking to Johan today. I'm like, are you going to come by today? He's like, well, due to the host overload.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that with the exception of Dan, the rest of the regular hosts here are the I did not go to Gen Con crowd.
That's right. I did not get
to meet any of you in person.
That's because the I go to Gen Con crowd is sitting out on the couch right now playing Xbox.
Actually, they're drinking beer and watching the Cardinals game. But I actually do have some comments on that, but I'll save it for a blog post. If anyone wants to know what's going on with the hosting arrangement, check the blog. It's really not worth taking time on the show. So let's get down to stuff we do want to talk about on the show. First up, we have something kind of new that is being...
Nude.
And you.
I posed for another statue. It was a nude of me singing Deep River. A guy by the name of Alex, he goes by Lizard Farmer on the forums, is trying a thing right now where he's creating transcripts of our show.
This is the best thing ever.
Well, and I say he's trying this because he is successfully creating the transcripts. That's not the try part.
You don't understand. This is awesome for me. Because I only listen to the show when I'm not on it if I know that I've been mentioned, because I want to hear what the guys are saying about me or how they're making fun of me. I looked at the transcripts for the last show. I mean, because he put a link out there and it's this thing. And I'm like, okay, I click on links. I went to it. It's like, oh, well, this is pretty interesting. It's a text document. Control F, Chad. Fine. Yes.
Oh, you're not egotistical at all.
Hey, man.
Chad, you've hit on it, because that's pretty much the only reason I listen to the show too.
There you go.
So I say trying because
you want to hear what they're saying about me. I get it, Keith.
These transcripts are free. You do not have to pay for them. We do not have to pay for them. What he's trying to see is if he can pull sufficient marketing dollars through ads and such that are just displayed on the page along with the transcript and make this a profitable model. So if you are interested in seeing these transcripts, or you just prefer reading to listening, or quite frankly, if you have a friend who is hearing impaired, who cannot otherwise consume this show, then start checking the show notes for the next few shows, because starting back with 246 and going on for at least a couple episodes while we do a trial on this, he is going to be doing full text transcripts of the show So you can use those once again for hearing impaired friends, for reading, for trying to quote us and when you're trying to prove us wrong in debates thereafter.
Look, it's in writing and on the internet. You know,
these are a great reference for us because by the time
transcribe the Crimson Pumpkin episode,
by the time some of these drop, we have no idea what we said.
Actually, no, Chris, the one he started with is a regular episode. The Crimson was two back. The one I'm talking about was one back.
Yeah, I don't know how many times Chad said when someone posts something in the episode review threads, Chad will go, I don't remember saying that.
Yeah.
Well, now we can click on a link and say, here's where you said it.
That's right.
Here's
That's
what
right.
you said.
All right. The other announcement I've got is we do have our next March of Dimes charity auction ready to go. This is one that we are doing in partnership with the GMing advice website, Gnome Stew. And here's what the guys at Gnome Stew are putting up to offer. And by the way, if you're not familiar with Gnome Stew, you can
Is it stew with gnomes in it or stew yes. that gnomes make?
It's a stew of gnomes. It's actually, they have actually a pretty graphic site logo.
I'll go visit them.
Gnome Stew, G-N-O-M-E.
Sold. E.
Stew. I don't know how I just spelled that, but yeah, gnomestew.com.
You can check the transcript.
What they're offering is the following, and I will, of course, put a link to the charity auction in the show notes. And once again, 100% of this will go to the March of Dimes. There is no administrative cost or any of that other crap. Every dime you pay goes to March along with the other ones. But what they're offering is, a copy of the Eureka softcover and PDF. This is an RPG they've created. One of the final copies of Masks in hardcover plus the PDF. They will allow you to be a gnome or command a gnome. And what this means is you either write the first ever guest article on Gnome Stew, subject to their review, or command them to write a system-neutral GMing article for which you will appear on Gnome Stew, your choice of topic. They will do an online game with Patrick Benson, Gnome Stew's own Patrick Benson, who will run a friends-based game on Eureka or Mass, their two systems. They will do a black and white character portrait provided by Christopher Reach, the cover artist and one of the interior artists for Mass. And they will also do a black and white portrait of your adventuring party from the game of your choice by the same Christopher Reach. So pretty cool package out there.
That's like a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff. So if you want to get this stuff and you want to support a great cause in the process, we will be running a 30-day auction on eBay. Mm-hmm. And I will link that in the show notes. And that is the outline for the wrong episode. So let's get back to the proper episode. First off, let's introduce our
I'm glad this came from the notes guy. It somehow feels vindicated.
Well, I was just flipping through the pages. So I flipped past the page for interview 19, behind which is the list of what Gnome Stew is providing. So I'm ready to go back to the show. So I just flipped pages again. And since we're doing a double header tonight, I pulled out episode 247. So we almost rolled in the completely wrong show. But let's start by introducing the two guests we have here with us. Joe, do you want to kick this off by telling us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why people should pay attention to you?
Well, as it relates to our role-playing games and such, my name is Joe Wetzel, and I guess primarily I'm known as the creator, author of the software mapping program Hexographer. It has a sister product called Dungeonographer. Got a bunch of other tools out there. Most of these things are free or at least have free versions, such as there's a coat of arms design tool. There's a free city designer, that sort of thing. And then most recently, in addition to keeping all those things maintained and adding new features to them regularly, most recently I did a Kickstarter project for something called Dungeon Morph Dice, which are three different sets of five dice that have little dungeon geomorphs on each side, and then you can just roll up your own random dungeon.
I was actually playing around with those at Gen Con. I went by and visited that booth originally. I was just looking for Keith, and then Keith got me over there talking to Joe, and the more I started looking at their stuff, I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. Because it's like, it's first like, hey, here's a hex thing where you can kind of make maps of fantasy worlds. Well, that's pretty cool. And here's a little thing where you can like build rooms. Okay, cooler. And star maps. And then I'm like, and can I change this to make this scalable for Battletech? And he's like, yes, here's how you would do that. Okay, this is getting better and better. So I'm like, why don't you come on the show at some point? So let's move next to the person that folks are probably more familiar with, but we'll do the introductions and formality. Keith?
All right. Well, my name is Keith Curtis. I'm probably known best on the forums as Keith Curtis. I've been doing work in the RPG industry for about 10 or 15 years now. Probably have, depending on how you count it, somewhere between 100 to 200 publishing credits. And the latest one to be coming up is, of course, Blood Moon Goblins, which should be well known to all Fear the Booters. And I've probably done about, I would estimate somewhere between 1 and 8 million icons for Dungeonographer and Hexographer.
Actually, you've done between 1 and 8 million icons for yourself on our forum. So it's like part of the weekly routine. It's like check Penny Arcade for the new comic, see what Keith's current animated avatar is.
The current one is an homage to the upcoming debut of The Walking Dead.
The last one I saw was the Pirates one. I was a fan of the Pirates.
On this one, after about 10 seconds of being up, the eyeball falls out and rolls down my cheek.
My favorite one, just simply for its subtlety, is the Yoda one. I'm not even a fan of Star Wars, but you just sit there and watch it and watch it and watch it. Doesn't do anything. All of a sudden it goes, sticks its tongue out at you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that one.
I will link all this stuff in the show notes. So if you are interested in checking out the software that Joe and Keith have been working on, I'll give you links to that. If you are interested in seeing Keith's artwork or commissioning him for work, then I will also put links to a bunch of stuff Keith is doing, including the Blood Moon Goblin site, which has now been converted over into a development blog that John is posting on. And he is posting some previews of the art that Keith is doing for him. In fact, Keith, I do have to say, the character that I played in that campaign, which has now made it into the campaign setting, did you intentionally make him look like me?
No, actually. Do you think he does?
Yes. Find a picture of me back when I had long hair. Put that next to it.
I'll have to hold on. I'll call it up.
I just assumed that was intentional. I'm like, Keith has a sense of humor. He did this on purpose.
Did you even know that was the long character Dan played when you created it?
Yes, I did, because I'd heard Dan talk about him a couple of times. Let's see here. Oh my gosh, you're right.
All right, so let's get down to mapping. I've got a bunch of things I want to talk about here, and I know these guys do too. The first thing I want to hit on here is the importance of having maps in a game. As people that tend to play somewhat paperwork light games, of course Chad and I are on different sides of this, but even I don't come with huge stacks and stacks and stacks of paperwork, I still think maps are important to a game, and here's why. Now, if you're doing something that requires map-based combat, whether that's D&D 3rd or 4th edition, whether that's Battletech, obviously the need for a map is pretty self-evident. But let's say you're doing a pretty fast and loose story-based RPG. I still would love to see a world map or an area map for a couple reasons. First off is a miscommunication or divergent understandings of a layout. I have seen way too many situations in an RPG where people did things they didn't intend to do because they did not understand just how big something was or where everyone was standing or whatnot. And a map gives you a way of putting out not just where the characters are standing, but what the setting as a whole looks like. The second thing is the consistency of locations. If you say it's to the east this week, it will be to the east 2 months later when it comes up again and everyone's forgotten about it. The third is travel times. This figures in the consistency of location. You can figure out, okay, the enemy army is going to take this many days to march to your capital and attack it.
Wow, that completely conflicts with one of my points that I was going to make.
Hey, you know what? Go, debate me. That's the point of these discussions.
One of the points that I was going to make is to remember that maps aren't fixed. Think back to, you know, Middle Ages and stuff. People didn't know much beyond, say, England if they were based in England. They didn't know what Europe really looked like. It looked a lot different in one map versus another map. The New World, of course, there was argument about whether or not it was even there. Then once it was there, it has different shapes and different maps, even by different people done at the same time period. My point is that if you suddenly, for a plot reason, decide, gee, I don't want that empire over there. I want it down there, or I don't want it at all. You can easily say, hey, the cartographer who did that on that expedition was wrong. They got lost.
You know, I was going to debate that on one hand, because of the fact that even if the maps were wrong, there is still only one reality. London is so far from Paris. I mean, that's whether the cartographers got it right or not. But actually, upon listening to you say that,
well, I guess where I come down to is, what is the point of the campaign, the game? You know, one of the things I like is Straczynski has the quote of, you know, how far away was one race's home planet from another race's home planet, and how long did it take to get there? He said, they travel at the speed of plot.
Well, and that's kind of what I was going to say, is hearing you phrase it that way, I actually agree with you that I think there could be a risk that eventually you let the paperwork own you. You become such a slave to your own stuff. You become so rigid in your thinking that you let a map, for example, trump your ability to tell a story.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too far down that path either, because you're right. It does help to have an overview of the campaign world to kind of get your players involved and so that they can remember that this is the empire over here versus this is a little kingdom over here. So there certainly is value in having it. I guess my point is that if there's a reason why you need to change it, there are certainly many ways to make that work.
I think it also depends what the purpose of the map is in your game. This is the map your characters have. This is what they know of the world. Or is it, this is the world. Your characters may not know everything on here, but this is the world you're playing in. It's just the context. Is the map something that your characters have in-game? Or is the map something that you're presenting as the GM to say, this is it? I think you have a lot more flexibility if it's what the players have.
Well, I think a map is a great prop for players. I mean, say you don't even play a game that has props in it. Even to give them a rolled up parchment with a map, they can always whip that. I mean, it's not like a goblet or a dagger prop or a skull prop or something like that, where they just kind of use it as a role playing toy. But if you have a map that is a player prop, it's also something that they can use. Instead of just pointing it at somebody and saying, you know, some saucy lines, they could say, okay, well, we're going to go here. And then they point to it. And then you as a GM know it's like, well, there's an error on that map or something. And
well,
you lead
exactly.
Astray.
So I was going to point out that an important usage of a map is, you guys have often said that the stuff that's on your character sheet is the thing that you can individually control. In some games, you've got the idea that everything behind the dice screen is the thing that GM can control. The map is kind of a middle ground. Say the GM creates the map, but he's giving it to you, and that gives the players, it becomes an extension of the characters in the fact that they can start to personalize their space by saying, like Chad was saying, oh, this looks like an interesting place to go. That becomes a decision that's in their control.
Yeah.
And if you want to see like a bunch of players suddenly just spend about a half an hour arguing, let them acquire a spaceship with like cabins that are on the map and watch them spend a half an hour arguing who gets which cabin and why.
Well, you hit on something that for me, a map is options. When I'm playing a game, if say Dan's running the game, he describes location A and location B. In my mind, I feel I have two options. I can go to location A or B. But if instead he describes location A and B and lays down a map and it's got two or three other cities on it, the whole world is opened up for me. I see where A is, I see where B is, and I see these other places. And I don't think I have that bigger picture without the map.
Well, one thing that I wanted to say, too, is that Keith hit on personalizing the map. I mean, that's not something you can do with your prop goblet or prop skull or prop dagger. You have an adventure where you go to the crossroads and there's a bridge and there's a bridge troll there. It's a role-playing encounter, and you talk your way past it, and it was very dangerous and really cool. And you draw a little skull and crossbones or a little cartoon image of a troll right on the bridge. And then, you know, months, years down the road, you could say, oh, remember that troll that was right there? Or, you know, it's like you have some friends who are going down that road. Oh, hey, look, this is where we found that troll. It doesn't have to be all about trolls, though. It could be about other things, too.
Like gnolls.
Or gnolls, yeah.
Yeah, it does. It gives you some serious options, too. I mean, and things you might not have otherwise considered. Let's say your character inherits a castle, and the GM hands you a map of the castle. Well, all of a sudden, there's like you see the word portrait gallery on one room, and then you think, I'm going to go there. Who's in the portraits? Why? There's a kitchen on this. I'm going to go get a sandwich. Who's the cook?
Do you think that's intimidating, though, to some GMs because of the fact that if they're not good at thinking this up on their feet, by putting down a map, they're inviting those kinds of questions? And I realize some GMs would eat that up, but do you think other GMs, that's an intimidating possibility?
They should definitely be prepared for those kinds of things. And if you are going to make a map and have it there, you should at least have a vague idea of what those things are, because you know you have to expect your players to be able to do that kind of stuff. And yeah, you might have to do some thinking on your feet, but you know, just like we made the point before, just because you have a plot that's going to happen at point A and they decide to go to point C, there's no reason why you can't adapt what you had in A and move it over to C. Yeah, it might take a little mental and verbal dexterity to do it, but you know, you got to be ready to do that kind of thing, I think.
I think it's only going to be a problem for the GMs who fall between the two extremes. I mean, if you've got like a GM like Dan or probably myself, if I hand you a map of that castle, I've got notes. I've got reams of notes on what everything is, and I've spent some time thinking about it. Or if you have a GM, let's say at the other extreme, if you have Chad, who might have just, you know, scribbled out a quick castle beforehand, he's going to make it up on the fly, and that's where he lives. That's the sort of stuff he lives for. I think it's kind of the GMs in between, the ones who maybe are not quite good at extemporizing and really don't have the time to sit down and figure things out ahead of time. That's where you're going to run into problems, I think.
Going back to a world scale map, one of the things that I've always liked about those is I'm a strategic thinker. I'm a planner. I'm a schemer. And knowing that this city's here, and if I want to get here, I could ride this fast. The army only is going to march that fast. And here's a city that might help us. We might be able to get a runner down there. And it doesn't just have to be military. But you could talk about this in terms of, like, Wayne, you talked about plot options, knowing what else is out there. I like being able to see what's around me. And on the micro scale, one of the things that I have been burned by in the past, and it's not true of most GMs, but nonetheless is one of the reasons I like a map sometimes, is I've had a GM where every enemy is, when it's their attack, I am 4 feet and 11 inches away. When it's my attack, they're 5 foot and 1 inch away every turn. And I realize, okay, GM screwing people should not be the norm. If you have a GM like that, you got other issues. But nonetheless, it does help keep everyone honest. It helps keep everyone consistent.
And that's actually one of the points I was going to bring up earlier, is that I've always enjoyed a map in the games that I've played in, because it just kind of helps with planning what options you're going to have during a campaign. You know, just like in the game that we're playing now, Dan, or the game before the Star Trek game that we're in now, I think it was the Dungeons and Dragons one.
Yeah.
That it was very helpful to have a map because you can kind of plan what your next steps were going to be. You know, when we were getting ready to battle those one beings, kind of how are we going to approach it? You know, where can we go? Where is there cover? Where is there not? And so I found a map very beneficial just from the planning perspective when it came to battle, at least.
Obviously, this is a very pro map episode. And I do think that there are some very cool things that can be done with maps. But I have also seen it go to the other end, too, where people get too micro focused on the map instead of it being an abstraction or something that is used in combat. I've especially seen this for combat maps where you have the combat and you use the map and, you know, you are 4 feet and 1 inch away every time, both ways, no matter what, because it's there on the map and that's cool and everybody's fair and likes it. Or, you know, that rock is there. It's a rock and we know how the rules deal with it. And that's all awesome because it's all on the map and everything is defined. And then combat ends. And then people have a hard time switching gears mentally. Instead of saying, well, I walk over to his body, or I casually walk over to his body. It's like, click, 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 click. Wait, I'm out of movement. Is the turnover? I'm not to his body yet. Click. You know, it's not that bad. But I think that a lot of people have trouble making that transition away from the map.
This is where the Game Master has a very powerful tool.
Take it away.
Bingo. The right and left hand. Reach out, grab that map, and pull it away.
Well, and again, we hit on two different kinds of maps here.
Yeah.
The combat map is one thing, and that's one that I'm not a big fan of minis in most games. I think for a game like Battletech we're playing right now, we have to have it. But a bigger overall world map or universe map or, you know, something like that where you're looking at potential cities and things, I always want that on the table. It never takes away from the game for me to actually see what would my character know about the surrounding lands.
Well, but I don't think it's, you can just break it into either combat map and non-combat map. Because what I was referring to was, let's say, you know, I need to go somewhere and I want to figure out how I want to get there. There probably will be combat, but it's just helpful to know what terrain lies between where you're at and where you're going to go. So it's more of a macro scale, just like, do I want to take this route or do we want to take this route? So
you know how to picture it in your mind, too. It's like if Dan just says, you guys go from point A to point B. It's a long journey from point A to point B. And you're imagining that in your mind. Well, if you look at a map, you're like, oh, it's a long journey over mountains.
Yeah.
Holy crap. My character is kind of changed a little bit as a person,
exactly.
You know, traversing this. And or if you say, well, it's a long journey down a nice sunny road that is well patrolled,
right,
and that sort of thing, well, it's a little different.
I totally hear
what
gives you options for how you want to plan what your character is going to do, what decisions your character is going to make for at least traveling.
You know, when you can afford even the mapping options that these guys are presenting, where it's like a lot of free stuff. You're still talking about printing costs and that sort of thing. There's to get that on the table, there's still a cost associated with it. And one of the things that we did back in the day, I mean like way back in the day when we were teenagers in gaming, we didn't have a freaking dime to our name, is that we had what was called newsprint. I think it was called newsprint. It was a big pad of cheap paper. And it was like the same kind of paper that they print newspapers on.
Yeah.
It's that pulpy.
I think it was actually recycled.
Recycled. Yeah. The guy who bought the pads was an artist and he called it newsprint. So I have no idea what it's actually called.
It's called newsprint.
It is called newsprint. Okay. And, you know, it's these big, gigantic pads of really cheap paper. And we kept one of those. And I actually kind of wish that we would kind of go back to this. We kept one of those in the center of the table. And it was so quick and easy to use. It's just like, all right, I'm fighting this guy and I jump behind rock and he says, well, there's no rocks in this room. Well, I thought you said there's a rock in this room. Well, hold on a second. Sketch, 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 sketch. And it's just an overhead square, circle for a rock, tree or over. Oh, I see what you're saying. Or I walk into the grand throne room of whatever and you're just like, well, how grand is it? Well, here, let me sketch it out for you. Big, huge square, big, gigantic throne. You're just these little people off to one side.
Let me give you a frugal gamer tip then.
Okay.
If you go down to your local newspaper office, mm-hmm. when they print the newspaper,
what's
they
a
will
newspaper?
Be left with end rolls. Yeah, I work at a newspaper, so so I see these every day. They'll be left with end rolls. This is a paper that's got is towards the end of the roll. It's probably too curled to print on for newspaper purposes, or it's just that was a convenient place to cut the roll so they could put one of these giant rolls onto the press. And you can get those for either nothing or maybe just a token $2 or $3 payment, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of feet of paper there.
That's a pretty good idea.
As long as you want it.
Yeah.
This is useful both in games and in pranks.
Yes, it is.
So let me.
I have a scroll to write.
Let me kick one here. I can write the Torah. Let me kick one out here to Joe and Keith. Let's say that I'm getting ready to kick off a campaign and I want a map for my setting. Maybe I want a map for some of the individual locales. Where do I get started? I mean, how do you go from zero to a map?
At Gen Con recently, when I was there, I played a game called Dawn of Worlds, which was really interesting to me in that you started with one person just kind of draws out the rough outline of a few continents or whatever you kind of agree on. And then from there, there are rules for the players to change the land around, put a god into the world, make a race, make a city, and so on, and to affect other cities or other races that other people have made, advance them, give them a technology advance or a magic advance. And I've been experimenting, at least in the mind lately, with the idea of using that as a basis, a way to kind of start the campaign to get a lot of buy-in from the players. At least in my experience, you know, if you kind of go away from one of the more common settings or kind of just go with a Tolkien fantasy kind of a world, you don't get buy-in from some of the players sometimes. And so I thought that this is a great way to get everybody together and everybody knows these are the races that we have and here's why. And you kind of get a shared history going on. So I found that very interesting and I want to try that.
No, and then Joe, what is the ultimate goal of the game then? We just create the world and then be done with it? Or what do you do in the end?
No, you know, there's three different epics, if you will, where you have nine turns. First epic, if you will, takes 1,000 years each. And the next epic is 100 years each. And then you have 10 years each. And at the end, the end game really is not a winner or loser necessarily, just a shared fantasy world that you can go off. And really, part of the intent, I think, from the creators, and this is available as a free PDF if you go look around for Dawn of Worlds, it's out there. And it's really a way for, say, a fantasy author to come up with a game world, for a role-playing game group to come up with a game world. That really is the intent.
Does it require being face-to-face? Could you play it over Skype or over a text chat?
Where I saw it first, as I said, I played it at Gen Con, but where I saw it first was just occasionally where I do a Google search for Hexographer just to see what people are saying about the product. I found a group of people using Hexographer to actually create the world, because a big part of it is, you know, changing up the land. You start with the rough continent outlines, and then you say you want to put mountains here and you want to put in a forest or whatever the case might be. And people on their turns, they have so many points per turn, and they can spend points to change the landforms. And for example, early on in the early epics, it's very easy to change land because, you know, you have 1,000 years is what you're representing, and it's not as many points. Whereas later on in the game, where you're in those 10-year phases, you have to spend a lot more points to change the land. Whereas on the other hand, advancing a race is kind of opposite, or placing a new race is kind of opposite, where in ancient times where there's no people yet, it's hard to place a race. But later on, you can place a race more easily, and you can make a sub-race more easily with fewer points.
Keith, what about you? If I was to come to you tomorrow, and I'm sure you've gotten requests over the years, probably it's ridiculous, and just said, hey, I need a map for my world. And that's as much information as I give you.
Like my wife at Barnes & Noble.
I would say, give me more information. No.
She says, like, yeah, somebody comes in, I'm looking for a book. It has a green cover, but I don't know what the author or the title is or what it's about.
Could you write it for me?
Yes.
Could you write it for me?
Well, I have done something along those lines. Back when I was doing work with Empty Room Studios, we had a kind of on-again, off-again project called Land E-scapes. This is back when E was more popular than I as your electronic product vowel at the beginning. But the idea behind it is they were generic maps. They just, you know, like a generic world map. No lettering on it, no names, no, just a vague sense of scale. In that case, I went with the typical, okay, most fantasy worlds usually have kind of a vaguely medieval European feel to it. So the majority of that map is going to somehow physically be evocative of Europe. It doesn't necessarily have to follow any of the actual outlines, but you're going to have kind of like a long sea to the south that separates you from a wilder area. You'll have an island or group of islands in the northwest, that sort of thing. That's one approach to take. But generally, when I am creating a map, say for myself, for my own campaigns, and I think I might have touched on this last time I was in, people talk about top-down design or bottom-up design, where you either start with like bottom-up would be where you start with the general area that the players are in and kind of work your way out, and then top-down would be where you'd come up with a whole world idea and then just kind of like gradually get closer to the players. When I'm designing a map for a campaign, I'll work what I call back to front, which is where I decide at the beginning, okay, what is going to be the main action of this campaign? Is it going to be exploration? Is most of it going to take place with ruins or jungle or something? And say a lot of it's going to take place with exploring ruins. Maybe I have an overarching mystery that they're going to be solving that has to do with why some civilization fell. I'll come up with, okay, here's where I want them to be. I have to have a reason why the ruins aren't too easily gotten to, so that everybody and their brother doesn't have picnics over there. I'll have to figure out what caused that to fall, what caused this other civilization to rise. And then I kind of working history and geography at the same time in trying to figure out what would make this situation arise. And that might just start off with just big blobs of, okay, city over here, big continent. Here are some mountains in between that keeps it hard to get to the ruins. And then you just kind of work, okay, why can't they go around the mountains? Well, there's the swamp of terror to the south and the frozen waste to the north. Okay. And then you just kind of figure out why things are on the map based on the kind of campaign you want to run. And that's pretty much, my philosophy for not only map building, but also campaign building.
I guess you can mix in society there too. I mean, if you've got an area where they could get to these ruins and they're not, why aren't they? Look at Planet of the Apes, the original one. There's whole right. ruins that you can easily get to, but they don't go there because they're forbidden.
And there's a reason why they're forbidden. And then you work that into the whole idea.
To add to all that, when you're thinking about your campaign, you want to not only think about top-down, bottom-up kind of approaches, I think that you want to look at what's important to the campaign. If you're going to have a campaign with a lot of political intrigue and stuff, maybe you need to start with that part and then work your way to the maps later. If you're going to do something, say, more historical, then you want to pick that nation that you want to pattern it after and build that up and then move into the other things.
So if you're going to map out ruins, have you ever mapped out what was there before and then converted that to ruins? Here is the city that used to exist. And then from there, you start tearing down buildings and
I have
create your new
city.
Map on that.
Yeah, well, in my current campaign, I do that all the time. And I bet you do it all the time for Skies of Glass.
where you pretty much have a very detailed, you know, beginning point. And you know, I had a campaign that took place in Montreal, so I had to, you know, learn all kinds of stuff about Montreal and discovered it's got tons and miles of underground construction. I mean, you can walk for miles without ever seeing the skies. Wow, just what a great place to explore.
Keith, you are completely correct. In fact, in the most recent campaign we did set in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, I actually had up on my computer a Google satellite view of Cape Girardeau and actually had down to the street corner where their little hangout was and all that stuff, had farms placed in places. I did something. There's a park nearby where a bunch of hooligans were hanging out. That's where the infamous Pat lead pipe killing occurred. But one of the things,
a horrible person.
Such a wonderful game.
But, you know, I also took existing buildings. I looked, for example, when I was trying to figure out what to do with City Hall. And at another point, I wanted a church in there because I wanted a priest who was kind of active in town affairs. I was actually doing Google searches on things in Cape Girardeau and pulling up images and using them to fill stuff in. But actually, this leads to my next question. Let's say that I'm setting up some kind of a large-scale setting. It's a world map for fantasy. It's a ruined city for a post-apocalypse. It's a galaxy for a sci-fi setting. One of the things that I have always found is difficult is I may know there's a half dozen things I want to be out there. I know this civilization needs to be there. These ruins need to be there. This capital needs to be there. But when you look at land area, you still have a lot of detail and a lot of space that needs to be dealt with. Something is there. How do you guys go about filling all of that in?
Well, I don't start filling it all in usually. I detail those 8 or 9 or whatever areas that I know I'm going to need. And I think it's important to intentionally leave some of it unresolved, because you never know when you might have a really great idea. And if you've gone too far in your detailing, it becomes hard to say, oh, well, there's a, you know, you're attacked on the way from city A to city B by, you know, the barbarian horde of X, when you didn't really leave room for a barbarian horde. But if you've got, you know, some empty spaces in there, you can detail those as, you know, as the time comes up. And truth to be told, I don't know how much detail would never get used. If you had, say, like a continent where you had detailed, you know, every square mile or so as to who was there, what, and why, I would say that 95% of it would never get used. And the 5% that does get used, probably 90% of that would only be used once.
And how would you keep track of all of that? It's one thing if you say, well, this is Farmer Brown, and this is Farmer Brown's house, and this is all the stuff about Farmer Brown, and Farmer Brown doesn't leave Farmer Brown's farm. That's one thing, but when you start putting in all of this huge amount of content on your continent, and you make it all intertwined, and you make it really layered, you make it really detailed, and then you set those wheels in motion, I mean, it's easy to keep the big stuff sort of organized, but it's difficult to keep all of it organized all of the time and to keep it flowing and right.
You're kind of, in a certain sense, screwing yourself over if you add that level of detail, because you're not allowing yourself much improv room if you need it. I mean, if you have all these details there, it's nice, and it's nice information.
You don't have to use it. But if you put that much in, why aren't you using it?
Well, but then by the same token, if players do something unexpected that, you know, could really end up derailing the campaign, and you need to come up with something to kind of get things back on track a little bit, you might be stuck by your own, you know, regimentation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, though, on the flip side, in some settings, you can get away without filling a lot of stuff in. I think the thing that would concern me is a lot of times players will ask, well, what's here? Well, what's here? Well, what's here? And in certain settings, I can say, well, nobody's really sure. But if this is something like a modern day setting or a futuristic setting where there's not been some massive eradication of technology or collapse of civilization.
Right. Again,
that's
the internet,
not really a play. Yeah. Find. Bingo. Yeah. I do space Google and look it up.
And I love space Google. It's almost like a space Wikipedia.
And nobody knows.
They never had that on like Star Wars, you know?
And yeah. The only way I found to deal with this efficiently is, for example, in Evacorisis, I'll just overwhelm them with so much information, they glaze over and never ask again. Jokes aside, I mean, in a way, by leaving that empty, can't you almost be, I don't know, inviting kind of some break of internal consistency in the world?
I think it's a service to your players to limit their choices, or at least give them the illusion that they have an infinite number of choices. Let's say your campaign is a much smaller area. Everything takes place in one fantasy city. You're running something like the Watch novels of Ankh-Morpork on Discworld. Big fantasy city, lots and lots, like nearly a million people. But there are maybe only 100 locations that anybody really knows the names of. And of those, there might only be a dozen that really the players have any interaction with on a regular basis. In my current campaign, I have a large fantasy city like that. It's got the indication that there are hundreds or thousands of buildings in this city, but there might only be like one that's named every, you know, two or three blocks. And those are the ones that are going to be most interesting to the players. They really don't need to know where the candlestick manufacturer is or the tallow works to go along those lines. They might need to know, you know, where the stockyards are if they're going to, you know, I don't know, be speculating in beef futures or something. Or they might need to know, you know, where can I buy a horse? Where can I buy a sword? Where can I go get a drink? The sorts of things that they're going to be doing. And then you detail like, you know, five or six interesting taverns. Yeah, there are a lot of other taverns in the city. Who cares? They're boring. These are the fun ones to be at.
Let me talk about filling in something else in the game world. Actually, this is one of the reasons why I asked Carla specifically to be on this episode, because while it is not her trade, her degree is actually in meteorology.
And yay.
When we talk about, I'm not sure why that got a yay, but yeah. Okay. You have a fan.
Oh, no, I've been looking forward to this, actually.
Oh, okay. And I realize we cannot, in the course of 5 or 10 minutes of this episode, educate anyone in climatology. But I would at least like to talk about that a little bit, because if we presume that a planet has basically Earth-like conditions, when you put mountains here and deserts there and an ocean here, things occur. And I was wondering if you could just kind of talk at the high level how these sorts of things all play together. And I realize this is a huge question you can't possibly tackle at all. But
well, I guess the first thing I would say is it really just depends how important accuracy in your map is. I mean, if you're just creating a map just to help the people in the campaign understand kind of where things are and have kind of a visual aid to help them with their plans and how they're going to handle traveling or whatever other reason, then I don't know if you really need to worry about all the actual meteorological, you know, nuances that take place as far as why things appear on the Earth, like you said, if it was an Earth-like setting. But in a nutshell, I mean, there are some things that are pretty standard on the planet that you could apply towards a map. It is kind of a lot to talk about in a really short amount of time.
No, I know. Just grab a few examples.
But a good example would be like a desert. Deserts typically form on the side of a mountain range. It's called the lee side of the mountain range, where the mountains are going to block the wind coming in from whatever direction. So in North America and the United States, we're accustomed to the westerlies, which people have heard probably through the television meteorologist, but most of our weather moves from east to west, or from west to east, rather. And so if you have a landmass to the east side of a mountain range that is significant enough to block the weather moving in from the west, you can very easily get a desert on the eastern side of the mountain range. But of course, it also depends, you know, where you are in relation to the equator, the Tropic of Capricorn and Cancer and all that stuff. But you were wanting to put a desert on a map, you would probably want to say, okay, well, we're going to treat this like the northern hemisphere of Earth. So weather is going to move from west to east. So we'll put the desert on this side of the mountains. The same thing applies to jungles, you know, where you're going to put jungles or where you want to even put, we're talking about deserts. Most people associate deserts with warm deserts, but you can also have cold deserts. A good example would be Antarctica. It is considered a cold desert. So there are actual things that you can consider when creating your map of where you want things to appear. But for the most part, it's really just going to boil down to how important the game master wants, how accurate he wants that map to be.
Going into this, I know we can't do a full education in climatology in the course of the show. And also there are a lot of things that figure into it, such as, for example, the direction the planet rotates, how much the planet tilts. All kinds of things that figure into this. But I think there are some low-level consistency things that you can go for by giving yourself just a really quick, I mean, Wikipedia-level education in climatology.
That's a pretty low level.
That is very low level.
Yes, it is. Well, but I mean,
it's all you need.
Well, but to Keith's point earlier, when he was talking about creating a map that was going to be, you know, in the Dungeons & Dragons Tolkien type, you know, it's usually going to be medieval Europe. Well, if you're going to use that as your basis, then okay, weather in that part of the Earth is going to move from, like we were talking about earlier, west to east. So you're probably going to say, you know, well, storms are going to originate in this area of the country and move this direction, you know.
How important is that for your average player? As far as I'm concerned, is if I'm a player in this game and somebody made this map and they put all this detail into it, I mean, that's cool and all. I mean, that's great. But
as long as it's plausible, you'll play along.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, that kind of goes along with what I was saying, is how important is it to you guys that the map is actually...
That's why I was saying that Wikipedia is, you were joking about it, but really, I mean, that level of detail is all you really need. You need plausible deniability or plausible suspension of disbelief.
And the other thing I was going to add was that even if it doesn't seem like it's something that would be likely to occur on a map, it can happen. You can have deserts right up against the ocean. It exists on the western side of South America. You have the world's driest desert that backs up to an ocean. So there are
water
things
you can't drink.
So there are things that are just abnormal. I mean, that's the nature of weather. I always tell people, you know, don't get mad at meteorologists because they're trying to put order on a chaotic system. I mean, that's really what it is. So you're always going to have exceptions. So really, well, I think it would be good to include, okay, well, this map's going to be pretty accurate based on this continent. I don't really think it's that important unless everyone you're playing with is a meteorologist, well, so we're storm chasing at the same
time. Somebody once said it's bitching at meteorologists why they can't tell the weather. It's just like, take an irregularly shaped ball, cover it in a semi-viscous liquid, heat it from one side, and then spin it. Now tell me exactly what's going to happen on that planet.
Yeah. Well, I realize that for a lot of people, as long as there's some kind of plausibility and consistency, they're not really going to care. Some people, I think, are going to want that. We're geeks and nerds. Mm. And if that happens to be your thing, there are some people who really will want that level of accuracy. And so I
think in some cases it could really come in for travel too. You have a hot air balloon. You want to know what direction the airflow is going.
You know, if I'm running a game and I say it's raining and somebody says, well, you know, we're in this low climate area where there's this mountain here and there's no way. It should be a light misting, not a heavy rain.
Okay, well,
and I shouldn't get a -2 to my hit with arrows. I'd be like, shut the up, wanker! And then flip the table over, and then we'd be playing Star Trek because there's no weather in space.
Well, let me though, real quick here, because I do agree with you that this can reach a level of pointless wankery, but obviously, I mean, here we're more talking about world design than the execution of the game. Mm-hmm. But there are two other things I want to talk about real quick. One is the logic of land features. Here's an easy example. Rivers. They originate somewhere, they terminate somewhere. This doesn't just
go downhill,
and they don't just start an empty land and end an empty land. There's mountains that feed them, or tributary streams, or there's
springs. If you have a river that comes from nowhere and goes nowhere, it's called a really long, thin lake.
And if it's not going downhill, I say if it's not going downhill, that better be a plot point.
Yeah, they don't cross from ocean to ocean.
There are actually rivers that do go
uphill.
Because
there's a high spot in the middle.
I do have one other thing, though, Carla, I wanted you to talk about here, at least once again, just at the high level here, which Wayne mentioned. There is a difference between Europe and North America, just one, which is even though we're actually pretty similar in terms of where we're at in north-south locale, Europe has, on average, warmer and less humid weather than North America has. Now, a lot of this comes from the way that air settles and winds move and such over the Atlantic Ocean. And I was wondering if you'd talk just a little bit about what's causing that, kind of what causes these trade winds and such.
Well, at a high level, I mean, it varies based on which level of the atmosphere you're talking about, but there are fixed high pressure and low pressures scattered throughout the globe. And where those pressure systems are situated controls how wind is formed. So basically, air wants to move from a high pressure to a low pressure. That's just one of the standards in physics, if you will. So air always wants to move from high to low. So you've got these fixed high pressures and low pressures, you know, at each of the different latitudes. So you start up at the North Pole and work your way down to the South Pole. Well, based on where those high pressures and low pressures are situated, the air is going to move that direction to those lows. And based on the spin of the Earth, which I think some of you guys know about the Coriolis effect, which is the rotation of the Earth and how it can deflect things. So the Coriolis effect in the northern hemisphere typically deflects things to the east, but in the southern hemisphere or closer towards the tropics, it'll deflect it to the west. That's why you see hurricanes form in Africa and moved towards the west to where we're at in North America. So based on that high level, you know, macro level, global highs and lows is where your air movement is going to occur. And so based on where Europe is, and I didn't research exactly like what causes Europe to have the specific situations that it has, but based on the trade winds, which is what's the air movement based on those highs and lows, I would assume that it'd be related to just whether the high pressure is kind of deflecting most of the air to the north or to the south and keeping that moisture kind of at bay and not letting it into the area. But without really kind of digging into what's causing the weather in Europe, I can't really give you but there's also mountain.
I'm given to understand that it's primarily the action of the Gulf Stream. And that if you think about it, Rome is at the same latitude as New York City. But you never see like foot deep snow in Rome. London is just about at the same latitude as the southern end of Hudson Bay.
Well, Rome is close to the Mediterranean Sea, so you're always going to have
that's a big part of it. Yeah.
You're going to always have a difference in weather pattern when you're closer to the sea. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The Gulf Stream is just a very fast, concentrated movement of those trade winds. So, you know, the Gulf Stream is just kind of the upper level winds that are occurring that are very strong and controlling kind of where the wind is moving all across the globe around the northern hemisphere. So you're absolutely right that the Gulf Stream
is... And they're quicker too. For instance, the oceans will act like a heat sink. They'll hold temperature for a long time. They will tend to warm up or cool down an area over over a long period of time over the course of the year or such. Whereas you get the winds give us weather, as opposed to just climate. They also give us a lot of variation from day to day or even from hour to hour.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the oceans, being that the planet is so much water, do have an enormous effect on how the temperature of that wind that's moving throughout the atmosphere, how well it's heated or cooled. Also, just the amount of humidity that's in that area based on those winds. So like a desert tends to kind of be a sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy because it's so dry, there's no clouds to deflect the solar radiation coming to the planet. So it gets really hot. But then on the reverse, when it's at nighttime, all that same radiation just leaves the earth. So all kinds of things related to just the humidity and the water vapor that's in the atmosphere. So you're absolutely right.
Which is why you can get away with a lot of exceptions to the rules.
Exactly.
And you can just say, hey, you're not a meteorologist or a climatologist in this world. There's just a desert here, and that's that's the reality of the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that's one of the things that I wanted to talk about this in passing, but certainly, I mean, in a creative exercise, you don't have to be a slave to anything other than the goal of everyone at the table
having
fun.
If I needed to rain on my players, it rains on the players.
Yeah. But one thing I did want to point out, depending on your approach to world design, is certainly you can put down your civilizations and then draw the world around them. And that's, once again, in a creative exercise, a perfectly acceptable thing to do. But if you like to approach it from the other direction, you like to take that Dawn of Worlds, yes, the Stone of Worlds game.
You wanted to say Dawn of War.
I was about to say Age of Wonders.
At least you were close.
If you take it from that standpoint, look, civilizations spring up in places because of certain things. Think about
They're completely unlivable, yet the tenacity of man makes it
keeps
livable.
Building in New Orleans. And, yes. Yeah. But think about
too soon.
How much of our modern world has been shaped by the path of the trade winds.
Mm-hmm.
A huge amount, obviously. How much of our world has been shaped by the location of rivers, locations of deserts, locations of oceans? It just goes on and on and on. And so if you take the approach that you want to design a world and then let it sort of organically populate itself, then knowing a little bit about these subjects could aid you in that. It's not necessary. You know, you're not a slave to any of these things in game development, but it is nonetheless a possibility. There's another subject, changing gears pretty heavily here, I want to talk about. Keith, this was something that you and I were talking about in email, and you were grinding an axe, not toward me, but just toward people in general, which is people don't tend to have a good sense of area and volume. Do you want to talk about that, or do you want me to start going on?
Why don't you start, because I'm not sure I recall the conversation and context.
The conversational context was 20-mile-long warships.
Oh, yes. I think I first came across that. I had a project for one of the mid-level publishers on Green Ronin's level doing maps for Babylon 5.
That would probably be Mongoose.
Yes, Mongoose. That's it. It was Mongoose. That's correct. But they have stated that the station is, 5 miles long? All right. That means that big cylindrical area is about 3 miles long. And it's probably about, you know, roughly about 3 miles around as well. Okay, well, that's what, you know, 9 square miles. But then you've got decks and decks and decks and decks. You could easily hide all of Los Angeles 20 times over. You know, in fact, if you made it solid, you know, deck after deck all the way to the middle, I mean, you could easily duplicate the living space of the planet inside of this. You know, it's only 10 feet tall, nested inside each other. But just the idea of, like Dan was saying, a 20-mile long, or let's use Star Wars, 100-mile across battle station. 100 miles? So I have to assume the Death Star can't be decks from North Pole to South Pole, because what would you do with all that space? You'd have trillions of people on this artificial planet.
You've got to have something that powers the weapons and things like that. So in some of these cases, that comes in as part of your design. You have a ridiculously big ship. Why do you have a ridiculously big ship? Oh, well, to do this, it needs power equivalent to 3 city blocks.
80% of that ship is engine that nobody lives in or goes in or can even touch, but it's engine.
I don't think it's the case with like the Death Star or any of that, but when we get to talk some other ships, that's been known to be the case, where most of the ship is actually engine, life support, air recycling systems, things like
and
that.
And the great big centrally mounted cannon.
Yes.
And I think the point that I would draw out of that, I guess, is, you know, if you want for dramatic purposes to describe really huge things, by all means, do it. It's a great storytelling device to have a starship that blocks out the sun. But if you are interested in detail, then don't bite off more than you can chew. Think really hard about exactly how big a land area, or in the case of a spaceship, a volume can be. And remember that this is now the area you're trying to deal with. And think about some of that consistency. You have a 20-mile-long warship. The captain's in the back doing an inspection, and aliens show up, and you need to get to the bridge to man the battle station.
Yeah.
See you in 2 hours?
Yeah.
Let's say you have an asteroid the size of Texas headed towards the planet Earth, and you get the best damn drilling team in the South China Sea to go up there, drill 1/100 of 1% of the way into the crust, and put 2 little nuclear bombs in it. You're not going to blow it in half. And even if you do, those pieces are still going to hit the Earth.
Exactly.
Michael Bay is on line 2. He begs to disagree with you.
Well, I think
let's discuss the Endor Holocaust while we're at it.
If he were only on line 2, this would be a 3-hour podcast as we discuss Transformers.
He would never get a word in edgewise to defend himself. You know, to that point about, you know, length and volume, in my gaming group, our GM was running a Fading Suns, and we had uncovered an Old Republic ship that was rather huge. And he really actually did a really good job of conveying the size and scope to us in regards to all the various decks and places that we had to go and the difficulty it was for us to get there. And things picked up for us when we were able to discover, you know, the internal tram system and get it to work, you know, to our advantage. But to have to go on foot to all of these places, it really kind of plotted things along. But it kind of slowed the pace of the adventure down. But he did do a good job of conveying the fact that this ship was incredibly large. And it was difficult to do. It was difficult to grasp that concept when he was first throwing it at us. But that helped a lot.
As we wrap the show up here, I want to go ahead and give Joe and Keith an opportunity here. Do you guys have anything going on right now that you want to draw people's attention to, or any stuff coming up that you kind of want to get people clued in on and starting to get excited about? Joe, you want to go first?
What I've done most regarding RPGs has been kind of online tools of different sorts. And one of the ones that I just did maybe last week was a different approach to mapping a world. Different for me, not different for people who've done a lot of gaming, but taking the old school Traveler icosahedral map template, planet template, I should say, you know, where you divide it up into 20 triangles, essentially, of hexagons each. And so I put out a free tool there on Inkwell Ideas. It's one of the first posts on that blog there that is just a free download. You just download it, double-click it if you have Java installed, and it will, by default, just make a world for you, a hex-based world with icosahedral template. And then there's, you know, 5 or 6 different values that you can change, what you want the climate to be like, if you want it to be colder than average or warmer than average, how much vegetation you want, how much of it is covered in land versus water, a couple of other things like that. And you can just, you know, keep on clicking regenerate, and it will just, you know, kind of generate a new world based on your settings each time. And then you can change individual hexes with a couple of controls on the bottom. So that was kind of related to mapping and world building. That was something new that I did, that then you can export it into Hexographer when you've got that.
And I will also, as I said before, be linking to Joe's stuff in the show notes. Playing with the Gen Con was pretty cool stuff. Joe, one of the features that you have in your mapping tool that I really love is it extrapolates. So let's say, for example, you want a world map and it's just thousands and thousands of hexes, and you know you want a forest here and a desert here and an ocean here. All you have to do is kind of take the mouse and just sort of squiggle generally where the ocean's supposed to be, and then do a little swath of where the forest is supposed to be, and then just kind of squiggle where the desert's supposed to be, and you hit a button. I don't remember what it was called, but
Terrain Wizard,
and it just fills it all out for you. It finishes the forest and finishes, so you don't have to paint every individual damn hex. You just have to kind of generally get it in the ballpark, and then it'll figure it out from there, and all you have to do is touch it up and drop the cities. It was very handy and is a lot less tedious than mapping programs that I've played with in the past. So I had much love for what I saw in that demo.
Yep, and like I said, probably there at the convention, one of the cool things is, you know, I've got it set so that my five-year-old not only was using the program, but she actually taught my three-year-old how to use it. Now, that's awesome. The three-year-old's maps, admittedly, are mostly volcanoes.
What's the problem?
It's a hellish landscape from which come fire elementals.
I would totally play in your three-year-old's
game.
Lots
of Jedi fights.
All right, so Keith, I know you've got, of course, you're working on Blood Moon Goblins with John. Of course, your main site can be found at kacurtis.com, which once again will also be in the show notes. Is there anything else you're up to that you want people to know about? Anything legal?
I was going to talk about three projects that would probably be of most interest to the listenership and to speaking to the subject we're talking about. Well, first of all, yes, Blood Moon Goblins. Yes, the work on that is going apace. We've done a number of character illustrations. We're going to be starting on some set pieces now, some action scenes and things like that. And another fellow from the forums who is working on the layout. And the project is moving along. It's really kind of fun and exciting. The second thing is I'd like to say that, yes, I'd like to give another prop to Hexographer. I've used primarily things like Photoshop, Illustrator, high-end illustration programs for doing most of my mapping, simply because, you know, that's my bread and butter. I feel very comfortable doing that, and it makes artistic style maps. But in terms of just ease of use and editability, there are a number of dedicated mapping programs out there for fantasy mapping. I have to give props to Hexographer.
Oh, and something else I wanted to mention, Keith, since I'm going to go ahead and interrupt you, is that, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the way that you have licensed it is, if, let's say, I'm in the middle right now of making my own game I want to publish as a PDF or something, that any maps created in Hexographer can be published without any further need for fees or licensing or anything. Is that correct?
I'll give you the 1 minute version of that. As far as I'm concerned, yes. Because the base icons are so similar to your classic Mystara icons, you know, if you're worried about that, there is an alternate set of icons that Keith has done in a slightly different style that only cost $20. So if you want that peace of mind, and if you like the style better, which I actually do myself, you can use those. But yes, you are free, as far as I'm concerned, to publish with the original or with the default Hexographer icons, and those are available for your use. And, you know, there shouldn't be any problems, but you need to talk to your own lawyer about that.
All right, so you're not going to sue anybody.
Keith, continue.
There was a third one I want to say, and I really can't say too much about this because it's really not my project in the sense that I'm heading things up, but Dan could say as much as he wants, is that we are planning some exciting things coming up with Epoch of Rysos beyond the alien races that we've done so far. And I think that there's going to be some really cool stuff up ahead there.
I do have quite a bit I could say, but I have opted not to.
That's why I didn't want to bring it up.
Simply not because there's anything super secret about it, but just because since John right now is doing the Blood Moon Goblins thing, I do not want us to be taking even 1% of attention away from that. But yes, do be watching for that. There's some stuff I'm working on with Keith. There's another guy by the name of Greg Christopher who will probably be contributing some stuff to this. But we are doing something with Epoch of Rysos. I just haven't been terribly public about it, because right now I want people looking at Blood Moon Goblins, because John's got a great product there, and I would hate to dilute any amount of attention that's headed that way. One quick closing note unrelated to this interview. The video game giveaway is still going on. If you want to enter for a Windows Live or a couple Xbox games, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'll continue to let that run through about mid-October. Beyond that, I just want to say a big thank you to Keith and Joe for joining us. And
thank you for having us.
Pleasure as always.
Very much. And as for the rest of you folks, you have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Bye.
Peace.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.